Hey, John, how are you?
Hey, Tony, how you doing?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we've had a chance to talk. Both been on the road for a while.
Yeah, it's been a busy couple of months, and I bet we're both happy to be home right now to just kind of have some time to decompress after all these exciting trips we've been on.
Yeah, well, for me, it was over two months away. I'm pretty exhausted.
Yeah, you know, I never go away that long continuously, but in the 2 months that you were in Tonga, I've been in the Bahamas on an Atlantic spotted dolphin trip. I was in the Alaska Katmai Coast for 2.5 weeks photographing brown bears. And then I just got back from leading a polar bear tour up in Arctic Alaska. So I've been back and forth, you know, every couple of weeks. So it's kind of nice to be home right now for a little while.
Yeah, racking up the frequent flyer miles, eh?
Yeah, you know, actually, I made MVP status this year for the first time with Alaska Airlines. So,
well, that's probably pretty important given how much you travel there.
Yeah, well, it's really important based on how much like baggage I take back and forth every time. So now I get free bags for the next year or so.
Yeah, that's really important. I get that on the airlines I fly a lot, too.
Yeah.
So you want to talk about any of the trips?
Yeah, so, you know, the trip that I did in the Bahamas was with Captain Scott on the Dolphin Dream that I know you've worked with before.
Yep.
This is the first time I've been able to do that trip. And, you know, for being able to just go there for a week round trip like I did, that was relatively short and accessible for me, and I had a really good time with the dolphins.
That's good.
You know, caught a couple of beautiful moments and spent a lot of time with them. And then, you know, what was real interesting though is I was the only American on the trip. And the other 9 people were all from Japan.
And yeah, it has a tendency to be like that on his boat.
Yeah, and a few of those folks have actually been on your trips with you to Tonga and some of your dive trips. So it was kind of nice to, like, you know, have that shared experience with them.
And
they all spoke very highly of you. What was really fun, though, was that only 2 of them spoke fluent English.
Right.
So the other 7, it was like I was giving slide presentations or camera assistance throughout the entire trip, and you know, was trying to do this all through the 1 or 2 translators, and a lot of pointing was going on. So you know, it was fun. We had a good time. And
well, that's good. That's
yeah
good.
And then in August I did the second trip where I used my small 22-foot boat to visit the Katmai coast of Katmai National Park in Alaska. And my friend Paul Souders and I took my little 22-foot boat all the way from up in Whittier. We drove down the Kenai Peninsula, took it on the ferry over to Kodiak. And then from Kodiak, we ran across Shelikof Strait in my little 22-foot boat. And Shelikof Strait has a reputation for being some of the most treacherous water in Alaska, the way that the wind and the tides combine there.
Right.
And I gotta tell you that, like, Paul had done this trip a few times before, my friend Paul Souders, and, you know, I knew he set my expectations for crossing Shelikof as, you know, not something to take lightly, mm-hmm. But I got to tell you, that first hour and a half of the 3-hour voyage, I was absolutely terrified. You know, we were out there in these big waves in my little boat and, you know, a long ways from land. And it was something not to be taken lightly at all.
Why was that? Is it the wind or currents?
You know,
or what?
We went over there on a day, instead of having perfect conditions, we had kind of a moderate seas building. You know, winds to 20 knots, seas were like 5 feet. And 5-foot seas in my little boat are pretty significant.
Right.
And with the tide ripping through there at the wrong time, too, you might get some, you know, added wave height. And so when we were taking, you know, some of those single waves might have been 8 feet in cresting, and
right,
real short interval waves, so they weren't long troughs between them. You know, that was very abrupt, that we had to take it right on the bow of the nose of my boat, and, you know, everything's moving around on the boat at that point, going up and down, you know, in vertical to horizontal positions. And you know, it was definitely I was just trying to keep my head down for a little while. And you know, we got halfway across, and like I took back over from driving from Paul, and I just floored it and kind of did the last little ways. You know, so honestly, out of the 16 days that I was over there, the scariest part was crossing that ocean and, you know, spending that the next 14 days living amongst the brown bears and being, you know, just feet away from them even, and taking these beautiful wide angle portraits and having the moms and cubs nearby. I mean, it was just absolutely incredible.
Well, were they aggressive in any way? Did they demonstrate any interest?
No, these brown bears have been somewhat habituated to people. And at this time of year, they're all gathering near these salmon streams to feed and put on extra weight for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're actually pretty leery of each other. You know, the last thing if you're an 800 pound bear you want to do is get in a fight with another 800 pound bear. That can be life threatening.
Yeah.
And so they had that same kind of look at us that took me a little while to realize how dominant I could be to an 800 pound bear. And
it's kind of hard to, I guess, you know, it's kind of hard to imagine, isn't it?
It's really impossible to like describe. And, you know, the talking about it now, showing people pictures until you've got an 800 pound brown bear that's only a few feet away from you. And you're talking to it, you know, you've got your bear spray out in your hand. You're talking forcefully to it, not terrified or scared or anything, but just forcefully and purposely. And the bear's, you can tell, is looking you up and down, trying to figure out, how do I get around this guy without this human messing with me either?
What's bear spray?
Bear spray. A lot of people in, you know, the Northwest, Alaska, we carry a bottle of basically mace, high pressure pepper spray.
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely bigger than, actually it's probably the same kind of size that you see like police and military forces use in crowd control.
Right.
It's like a big bottle, you pop the top on it, and then all you have to do is push down on the button and this hot pepper stuff comes out, shoots about 20 feet, which is very close. If you have to use it, you're in trouble at the last second, you know?
Yeah, I suppose you didn't have to use it, right?
No, but when a bear's coming that close to you, you've got it out in your hand just as a precaution.
Right.
And, you know, at 15 feet away, if the bear decide to go after you, if you don't have it in your hand, it's not going to be something you can grab at that point.
Right, right.
But, you know, at no time did I really feel threatened. I, you know, got a full appreciation, understanding, respect with the bears. You know, a lot of times they really didn't want to come near you. There were some areas where I was trying to do some underwater photography of bears that didn't work out, but I was trying, using a remote camera with a pocket wizard attachment. And in some of those areas by those streams, the bears were very close. It was very narrow. And, you know, again, there was just like a lot of respect going on both sides. So I never really felt in danger. And the entire time, all I kept thinking about was how I had to take my boat back across Shelikov Strait.
So you were more afraid of the water than
I really was. I mean, Paul and I were both checking the marine forecast every couple of hours, whether we were turning our marine radios on or calling speed dial on our satellite phones. That was really the most important thing to us, was what was the weather going to be like that morning, that afternoon, the rest of the week.
Right.
And I will admit, before the trip, Paul and I had talked about, since he owned the same kind of boat that I had and had previously done the outer coast of Katmai on his own, I had made arrangements that if I wanted to leave earlier and he wanted to stay longer, that I would trust him with my boat. Right. And I would fly out. And honestly, that's what I ended up doing. I flew out a few days early, and then he ended up staying an extra week and a half longer. And that just worked out for both of us at that point.
Right.
And then, you know, I came home for another couple of weeks, tried to get a little business done, enjoy the last few days of summer with my family. And then I went up to the Arctic for the first time to photograph polar bears with Steve Kozlowski.
Mm-hmm.
And we were co-leading a polar bear tour for the first time together.
Yeah, how'd they go?
It was really an amazing experience. It was a great first tour. All of our clients had an amazing time with us. I mean, you can't, again, describe having polar bears just right outside the bus window. You know, the closest I got was a bear was licking the window with my hand on the other side of the glass. I mean, that's as close as you need to be at a polar bear anywhere.
Right.
And then we also spent a number of days working on visiting the island that the bears spent the days on.
Yep.
And we used local Inuit guides with their small boats to go over to this island and we would get the boats right up to the shore. And the best pictures we got were when these bears came over. Moms and cubs were playing in the water, or they were just walking right along the shore. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these bears were coming within, you know, 20, 30, 40 feet of the boat. If they were swimming, sometimes they were swimming really close to the boat. I should have had a wide angle lens on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it
just were you afraid of those bears?
Well, so that's a good question, because though the brown bears, when you're around brown bears and they're used to being around people and there's a lot more respect going on, I never felt threatened by brown bears.
Mm-hmm.
Make no mistake, though, with polar bears, mm-hmm. those things would eat you in a second.
Right, right.
I mean, it's just, they're in their nature. They are just the dominant predator there in the Arctic, and that's what they do. They just look around for food all day, and if they see something they can eat it, they're going to bite it, you know? And I've been around, you know, great white sharks and tiger sharks and things in the ocean that are very leery of us, just like the brown bears. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you would really have to put yourself in the wrong spot, the wrong time of day or whatever, to get bit by a great white shark.
Yep.
And, but, you know, there's absolutely no way that you can spend any amount of time around polar bears without being under, you know, threat. And, but I don't want to scare people away. I mean,
sure. No, I mean, how do you deal with that, I guess, is the question.
Well, that's what I mean. So we were working either on a bus or in trucks with our clients, you know, old pickup trucks. Mm-hmm. And these bears would come up to the boat and up to the car. And as long as the windows were rolled up, you know, I mean, they were on the outside of the glass, but they were certainly pushing on the doors and pushing on the glass windows, you know, trying to see if they could rattle the bus. And, you know, the one bear that swam up very close to the boat, you know, it was very close to me. And I was like, make no mistake, that bear wanted to get in the boat with us. And I got all these fabulous pictures that make it look adorable because it was just swimming in the water and, you know, posing in beautiful sunset light. But, you know, it was definitely a different experience with those polar bears compared to the brown bears. And, you know, I posted a little video on YouTube the other day that shows one of my encounters that I had where I actually got on land when the Eskimo guides took us over to this island. We would stand on just the shore and see if the bears would get interested and then come over to us and then jump back in the boat. And, you know, these Eskimo guides, they've been, you know, their entire lives have been hunting seals on the ice in the middle of the winter. So they're used to being around bears, and they never felt like we were in any danger, but they had their rifle with them. And, you know, we walked a little bit on shore. And then when I got this one bear, a young cub interested in me, and it started coming, we very quickly retreated back to the boat. But I got some of my best pictures of the whole trip as I dropped down on my knee to shoot for a few seconds at a time as I was, you know, doing a calculated retreat back to the boat.
Right.
Is that the video
you mentioned? Is that the one that sounds like machine gun fire?
Exactly. So I shot that video with a GoPro camera attached to the top of the camera body.
Right.
And so it was kind of cool. Like, I've been trying to do that the last two bear trips, to have that GoPro camera record my what I was shooting with a big lens at the exact same time.
Yeah. So you just stuck it on top of the 1D Mark IV, was it?
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, I've got a little Manfrotto mini ball head that slides right into the hot shoe. And then I screw the GoPro to the top of that.
Right.
And, you know, if you listen to that video, the audio is not that great because I got the waterproof housing on the GoPro camera.
Yeah.
But you can hear me at the start, like, yelling like, hey, Frank, get over here. This is the best picture right now. And my client, Frank, he was a great trooper. He was really not interested in going on shore. I didn't want to make him do anything he didn't feel comfortable with. But then, you know, he decided he would go on shore for a few minutes with Eddie, the guide, and I. And Frank was already, you know, kind of heading back towards the boat by the time I was dropping down to shoot those couple of pictures. And Frank's got a picture on his website of me at that moment. And, it, you know, it's telephoto, so it's kind of compressed, and it looks like the bears are kind of more on top of me than they actually are.
Right, bear bait.
But, yeah. So, but, you know, we went on that island a number of times just on the shore, and the bears wanted nothing to do with us. They were playing, you know, 200-300 yards away, and, you know, so we had these amazing experiences, even though, you know, you're not getting these photos. of watching these moms and babies just play. And there was maybe a dozen moms with, like, you know, one or two cubs each. And they were all playing in the same meltwater, the same ponds, or playing at the ocean edge. And it's just absolutely this amazing nursery to be watching these cubs and moms interact and play. And, you know, that was really, that's when you're going to get these amazing photos, which is what all of our clients got. And, you know, the people that were with me on, when we were out there got pretty much the same pictures that I got. So it was really exciting. Everybody that was with us, including a couple of the people that were with us, were non-photographers, you know, spouses, just with their photographer partner. They had an amazing time. The whole experience of visiting Kaktovik in the Arctic, you know, the village there, the people were great. The hotel we stayed at, the rustic lodge that we stay at, you know, that was great. The food was great. And everybody wanted to stay longer. They would have liked the trip to have been a couple of days longer. And we said, well, we'll take that in consideration for next year.
Right.
People, you know, do want to stay on a longer trip. And, you know, but everybody got in 4 days, 3.5 days really on the ground with us. They got an amazing polar bear experience. So
basically you had them every day.
Every day. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, I didn't like anything. You don't get pictures every day. My best pictures came on 2 afternoons.
Right.
But, you know, we had polar bears early in the morning, late at night, middle of the day. I mean, it wasn't a problem to see polar bears. Even like the one or two people that didn't want to be out all day long would take the afternoons off because they'd seen enough polar bears before breakfast that they were like, oh, I'm going to take it easy this afternoon, you know, and
that's awesome.
Stay in the warm lodge.
That's totally awesome.
You know, the one of the creepier things that we did experience was the polar bears hang out on a sand spit, like a barrier island, during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would come across during the day occasionally, but mostly at night. And they would all come across at the same time.
Right.
So they would swim a mile back over to the end of the runway in Kaktovik. The Inuit there practice subsistence whale hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And so they still are allowed to harvest 3 bowhead whales each year in the fall.
Right.
And so they have butcher and divide the whale, they leave the bones and the carcass at the end of the runway. And so way down there at the end of the village, there's this bone pile. And then very conveniently, the bears swim across and feed on it throughout the day.
Right.
And, you know, at night, you could go down there and you could almost set your watch. Once the sun went down about 8 and it got really dark by 9, we would go down there with the bus or the truck, and we would park right by the bone pile. And all of a sudden, all these bears would emerge from the water at the exact same time. And it was mostly pitch black. So we've got spotlights. And all of a sudden, it was like one of these sci-fi movies where people are using spotlights to shine and they're surrounded by aliens.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was polar bears. And so, you know, we're no bears at all. And then all of a sudden you start moving the spotlight around and you see 23 bears.
Wow.
And they're all just right at the edge of like the beam, and they're all coming over to the whale pile to feed. And they're all on top of this, grotesque whale pile feeding on this thing. And, you know, it's interesting to see a couple of times, but it wasn't like the best photos. You can see a lot of pictures that have been taken at the bone pile over the year online.
Uh-huh.
But it was definitely a neat experience, and everybody enjoyed seeing that, is that, you know, the ruggedness and the rawness of that moment.
Right.
But, you know, after the first couple of nights of doing that, I was like, you know, I don't want to go down there to the end of the runway anymore at dark. It's just a little kind of creepy for me.
Yeah, well, yeah, I suppose it'd be interesting to see it once.
Yeah. Maybe. And, you know, we actually went to go photograph the Aurora Borealis one night down by the airport. And we were right by the airplane hangar.
Yep.
And, you know, we had to get out of the truck to set up our tripods, but we knew the bears walked through there. And it's like that was the time of day where they came over to the whale pile. So that was very scary, being outside of the car, just even like waving the flashlight around, taking a couple of Aurora photos, and then jumping back in the truck.
You right. know,
the entire time, it was like a whole different level of respect for that animal.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, basically you have no protection if they come to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they would have no problem. I mean, I just kept looking at these beautiful, adorable two-year-old cubs that I got these amazing photos of, and I kept thinking what they would do if one got one arm and one got the other arm.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they'd pull me apart in like 2 seconds. So, again, yeah. I don't want to scare people. I just want to, you know, say that they are the top predator up there in the Arctic and not to be taken, you know, lightly.
Yeah. No, I think it's important that people know what they're, you know, what you're dealing with and what the wild animals are really like. I think a lot of people forget that.
Yeah. I mean, this is not going to the San Diego Zoo and seeing the polar bear exhibit.
Exactly.
You know, this is going to San Diego Zoo and like sitting in the polar bear exhibit. you're the person in the exhibit and all the polar bears are coming around to look at you.
Yeah. At feeding time.
Yeah. At feeding time. Yeah.
Right.
So it was a really incredibly successful trip. Like I mentioned, we had 6 great clients. You know, some of them I think you might want to come back next year. And just the little bit I've been sharing the pictures already, you know, people are very interested in signing up for next year with Steve and I again. And, you know, we're going to soon we'll be updating the website with new photos and talking about, you know, the end of next September and the first 2 weeks of October in 2012, cool. Taking clients up there again. So. Very cool. Excited sounds, about that.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. So how about you and these whales that you just can't get enough of down in Tonga and the tropical beaches instead of the Arctic Ocean?
Yeah, well, I guess while you were playing with bears, I was down in Tonga where I spend about 6 to 8 weeks every year during, or every year for the past 9 straight years. This is my 10th season there. This year was pretty amazing. There were a lot of whales of all different descriptions, but there were more babies that we counted than ever before. I mean, we've only been counting meticulously for 4 years now.
Okay.
But, you know, our previous record was 31 mother and calf pairs.
Okay.
And this season, I am sure we have 45. I'm pretty sure that there will be more than that because I had quite a few that were, I just wasn't able to confidently ID while we were there. But I think after going through the data meticulously, which I have to start doing, and laying it all out, and then I can cross compare everything, you know, and look very carefully, they'll probably end up being more than 45, which is a huge number. I mean, if you think about it, I was there for, I don't know how many days I spent on the water, but let's say it's 2 months, right? So it's 60 days or less than 60 days, and to have 45 ID'd. Mm-hmm. Maybe closer to 50. You know, that's a lot of moms and babies. Certainly a lot more than I think people were willing to believe, you know, even just a few years ago. So that's obviously really good for the whales.
Yeah.
It was great for everybody who came to Tonga, or who went to Tonga, whether with me or with other people. But, you know, it was a banner year. It was just really, really fun. And there was so much, so many whales and so much to see. I think it's fair to say that I learned more about the whales this one season than all the others combined.
Really? That's saying something.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of it was that there were so many whales, and, you know, part of it was probably just the cumulative experience from before as well. But seeing the behavior and seeing repetitive behavior over years and years, and then kind of tying the various bits and pieces together and figuring things out. Like, just as one example, you know, humpback mothers and babies often have escorts with them, one or more escorts. And even when I first started, getting interested in humpbacks and spending time with them, people didn't know what humpback escorts were. One of the very common explanations was that they were females that were like nursemaids or midwives. They were helping out, you know, helpers for the humpback whale moms, because moms need helpers. A very human explanation.
Yeah.
As it turns out, at least as far as I've seen, every single escort I've ever seen is a male. So part of that, I think, well, the explanation, as far as I can tell, is completely wrong. And part of that was because people weren't getting in the water. If you get in the water and take a look, you can see they're male.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the most part, from what I can tell, from my own experience and from actually asking a couple of researchers in Hawaii that I trust, the documentation of these escort relationships is very short, you know, a couple of days, a few days here and there, with the moms and babies, and I'm not sure if people have paid a lot of attention to what they do. I know I haven't. But this year, just by coincidence, I paid attention to one particular escort that was staying with a mom and baby. It was very easy to identify because the baby had been attacked and had big scars all over it, large chunks taken out of its body.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, it was it's fine. It's really healthy. It's a big boy now, about half the size of its mom, and mm-hmm. very comfortable with people in the water, with other whales, very well-adjusted little boy.
Yeah.
But, you know, it made it very easy to find it and see it. So one escort stayed with it for a minimum of 14 days. We had photo documentation to show that, which is a lot longer than people thought, or at least I thought.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it starts to beg the question of, well, what is this escort doing with this mom and baby for so long? What's the male doing? And I think I got some insight into the answer because the last day that we saw this escort with the mom and baby, the three whales were being bombarded by other males. Like, really violent interactions and aggressive interactions. And these other males were coming charging in, and they weren't always around at the same time, but they were rotating. I could tell that there were different ones coming in. But there were probably 8 to 10 or maybe even more whales basically charging at this group, and the male, the escort, was defending. And we saw the violent defenses. I saw the first time when I dropped in the water that day, I saw the primary escort go full speed into the belly of another male whale and basically gut punch it.
Really?
Yeah. So, wow. You know, there had to be some purpose. Now, what gets really interesting is that 2 days later in the exact same area, we found that mom and baby again, and the primary escort was gone. There were other males in the area and other females in the area, and all this type of frenetic activity was taking place within visual range of this mom and baby. And there was, whereas 2 days earlier, it seemed like every single male in the area was interested in this mom. On that day, no male was paying attention to the mom. So you went from being the most, probably the most popular female on the block one day, and 2 days later, having absolutely no male attention at all, including the escort, the male that was with her for 14 days. So obviously something was going on. And, I think my explanation is that the escort stuck with the female until she was basically in heat, in estrus, and all the other males somehow knew that she was during that short period of time, maybe 24 hours or so, and they were all competing for the right to, you know, basically mate. And then when that period was over and she wasn't eligible anymore, they all split and went on to other females. So I don't know if that's true or not. That's my theory. And interestingly, after that, and after I started telling people about that, we documented another escort, long-term escort relationship, this one for at least 18 days. So it looks like there's something very interesting going on here, and I don't know if it's if it always happens, if this is an exception, mm-hmm. if this happens only in Tonga or not in other places, or if it happens all around the world. But as far as I can tell, it doesn't seem like anybody else has really noticed this before. So it's something that we'll keep an eye on. So it's stuff like this that was, you know, and a lot more. I mean, I could just keep going on and on, but a lot more stuff like this that we saw. Very interesting.
Well, I got to ask you, like, how many of these encounters tend to lend themselves to, beautiful photos?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
But, I think one of the good things about the project that I've been doing, which is counting the number of babies in Tonga every year, is, you know, where of course I want to be taking really beautiful photos, but, you know, in nature, especially in water with big animals, the percentage of the time that you spend with them where you'll be able to get a beautiful photo is going to be less than 1%.
Okay.
So you can either choose to be really frustrated with that other 99% of the time.
Yeah.
Or what I'm doing actually is making use of that time and learning about their behavior and documenting, you know, their patterns and what they do and trying to tease some knowledge out of that. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually making use of the downtime. So it doesn't matter to me so much right now. I mean, I get beautiful photos and, you know, when the opportunity presents itself, I know what to do. But most of the photos I'm taking are not in those circumstances, but I'm having a great time.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think, as I always tell people with humpback whales, like, you better enjoy the boat ride and being out there.
Exactly.
You know, that's, it's like, yeah, like, you can occasionally get some nice photos, but that's, you know, you got to put so much effort into this. And, you know, it was really interesting, at least kind of back to the polar bears. It's like, you know, I was a little bit concerned about whether a 3.5 day trip was going to be enough time to get anybody nice photos of the polar bears.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, now that I've been up there once, it's like, and I can see how it all works. You know, I can pretty much, you know, you can't ever guarantee anything, but I can guarantee you're going to see some polar bears, and you're probably going to get like at least one nice photo that you'd be really proud of in a 3 or 4 day trip. And I would never necessarily say that about a 3 day trip with like a humpback whale.
Oh, no way. No way. I mean, I did actually have some groups come, one group in particular, come for 4 days only.
Mm-hmm.
Against my advice, but they had incredible luck. I mean, mind-blowing luck.
Sure. I mean, people are always going to get lucky.
Yeah, I just, you know, and I did keep telling them, don't expect this next time.
Yeah.
You know, because you can easily go there for 10 days and get nothing. I mean, I did that first couple of years I went, partially because didn't know what I was doing, but, you know, I'd spend 2 weeks and come back with, like, nothing, literally.
Yeah. Well, and I know, like Steve Kozlowski, you know, he spent 13 years photographing the polar bears up in Barter Island.
Mm-hmm.
And they only started using the boats to go over and visit the polar bears during the day, like 2 or 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so before that, he used to just go out and sit by the bone pile all day. And then, you know, wait for the bears to come across,
right.
You know. And you could sit there and you could look a mile away and you could see 25 bears over on that island that you couldn't get to.
Yeah.
So, you know, now that we can use the boats to go over there and visit these bears, you know, that's definitely a lot easier to be able to get close to them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's stuff like that in Tonga too. After 10 seasons there now, there's things that I know to do and make things easier.
Yeah.
Yes. So, yeah. You know, John, one other thing I wanted to talk about, besides our great adventures, mm-hmm. was this, when I was, en route to Tonga, I started writing this, a response for those times when we get free image requests, or, mm-hmm. you know, when people write and say, you know, I have this great cause and I need like 15 pictures from you for free, which we all get. And one of my other friends, Matt Oldfield, had just gotten one before I left for Tonga, and he posted a response, which, you know, I know I've done, and I know everybody else has done. It was a pretty pissed off response.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and I know that when I send responses like that, I always kind of feel bad. I actually feel really bad later, mm-hmm. when I calm down. So I started writing a what I wanted to be like a standard response that everybody could use that would get the points across, but not necessarily, or removing the emotion, basically, the heat of the moment.
Yes. Yeah.
So I refined that during the couple months that I was there in Tonga. And when I came back, coordinated with Matt and showed you a draft. And then I posted it on the internet, basically set up a dedicated URL, posted it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just totally gone viral. And I we talked about this, I think, when we had Steve on one of these chats. And
yeah.
You know, what I've been seeing is that from getting literally hundreds and hundreds of emails a day, is that there's a lot of photographers all around the world facing the same situation. It's a lot bigger, or the problem is a lot bigger than I thought. I'm getting all these stories from all different types of photographers. I mean, we're talking about not just nature and landscape like you and I do, but sports, fashion, events, portraits, weddings, everybody. So it seems like we've touched on a really raw nerve.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty amazing that, you know, that many people have like responded to this so quickly.
Yeah. And it's gone on a lot of big sites where photographers mm-hmm. visit. I mean, I know like it's on Fred Miranda. It's on Sports Shooter. Petapixel picked it up today or yesterday.
Wow. Yeah.
And probably more that I haven't seen. But
Right. You know, I just shared that on Monday morning because you and I've been talking about it. And so hopefully I didn't open that can of worms prematurely for you or anything. So
no. I mean, yeah. I just wanted to make sure that the website was actually okay, because I set it up on a WordPress.com website, uh-huh. free. I didn't want it to be neutral so anybody could use it. Mm-hmm. And the text, I'll include a link. But the text is, you know, under Creative Commons, so anybody can use it. And I was also, I have been hearing from a lot of creative artists, not just photographers, but, you know, designers, illustrators, and other people, you know, who are actually going through the same thing. The one common thread, or couple of common threads, one is that a lot of people thought it was just themselves.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you often get this, you know, you're being so unreasonable line, and everybody else is not. And I think a lot of people were questioning whether, you know, saying, well, am I really being that unreasonable? And what this has brought out is this common experience is that everybody's finding out, no, it's not just them. And you know, people are saying, well, I'm getting a lot of messages saying I'm really happy this is out there, because now I know it's not me and I feel better about, you know, maintaining my position.
Sure.
And it's getting, I suppose it's just part of the change, like we talked about before, of you know, going to digital media, but it's just getting really hard for a lot of people to make ends meet. I know, you know, you and I are going through that, and probably a lot of other people that we know too.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, as much as whatever, the couple thousand people, maybe even the couple tens of thousands of people that have been affected by this that consider themselves, you know, creative professionals and, you know, are trying to make some kind of income, or if not full-time, at least some kind of income from their creative endeavors. You know, I guess it still doesn't stop the fact that there are, you know, more than 100 people, if not more than 1,000 people for every one of us that are, you know, coming into these creative professions and, you know, don't have the professional experience, don't know how to negotiate. And, you know, there's always, always going to be the people that are like, you know, well, you know, I'm going to give this stuff away for free because I don't have to make any money from it. And, you know, that's just becoming, you know, the symptoms are that people don't want to pay us what we need to be compensated for these difficult to produce images. But the reality is, I don't think that that's going to, you know, change anytime soon either. So.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to change. Yeah. I mean, I think the trend is so clear, and it's so much bigger than I thought already.
Yeah.
And I already had a pretty pessimistic view, and this has just made it worse. But, you know, I think putting that letter up has certainly put it in very clear perspective for me, put the situation in clear perspective. And I think there are three audiences for that. One is, you know, the buyers, mm-hmm. because it the good thing is it gives people who maybe aren't good at writing or who aren't confident enough to write something a reference. They can just point to the link if they want, or they can copy and paste the text or amend it, whatever they want. And, you know, what's great about the link is that you see all these comments and these other photographers and creative people, so you know it's not just you.
Yeah.
The other audience is, you know, other photographers, so people who are afraid to speak up and who will speak up now, hopefully. And finally is the people you mentioned, who are people, you know, who are maybe trying to break in or just doing it for fun. I think, you know, maybe hopefully if they read the letter, they'll think about it twice. I know some people certainly won't, but maybe they will think about it twice. If they are taking great photos or creating really nice stuff, they should get compensated for it, even if it's not a full-time job.
Yeah.
And if they decide to give everything away for free and they're good, or even if they're not these days, then they're actually, you know, actually hurting other people.
Well, that's what I try to point out to everybody. And, you know, I have that conversation with people and clients and whatnot that, you know, like, yes, there's things like the iStock business model might make sense for, like, I could take a picture of my light bulb on my desk right now and put it on iStock, but that's not the same thing as going to the end of the earth in this, like, personal expense, risk, and difficulty to accomplish, you know, as we've talked about, these kind of images that we're known for.
Yep.
You just can't price it the same. And, you know, I just always, you know, try to point out, I don't like to point fingers, but I like to, like, try to at least people, like you said, make people think about what they're doing. Like, you know, don't give away your image if you want to be respected by other photographers.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And especially, like, if you don't need the income from it, like, there's nothing that comes from giving away the image, you know? At the end of the day, like, I don't need another publication credit. I mean, I have enough publication credits. Like, that you know, novelty fades so quickly. What I need is people, like, I need clients, like, willing to, like, help support my work so I can continue to do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that's come up, another theme that's come up, is that a lot of these requests are coming from charities or nonprofits or educational institutions and things like that. And which is fine. I think a lot of us, or probably most of us, do contribute to organizations for causes that we have a personal stake in or believe in in some way. But, you know, you look at some of these requests, especially the one, you know, like even from a personal point of view, I get requests from organizations. I go online and I look at their cash accounts as of the end of the year. You know, they've got millions of dollars in cash on hand, and you know they want 30, 40 photos for free to use whenever they want, all around the world, in all forms, in perpetuity.
Yeah,
you know,
they don't even understand what they're asking, you know.
Well, that's the sad thing is, given if you read, I mean, I've spent the past 2.5 days, nearly all day, reading these responses.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of them are in private, you know, some people are commenting publicly, but most are private responses. I don't think it's on the buyer's part. I don't think it's being naive. I think it's intentional for the most part. It's trying to take advantage of other people, seeing what they can get away with because they have the money and they know that if there's so much bullying going on, you know, just saying, well, you're being, you know, unreasonable when... You know, I mean, reasonable people can come to reasonable terms. You don't have to, like, pay out the nose. And there can certainly be, you know, lower prices for certain causes and things like that. But I'm now firmly in the camp of believing this is not naive people requesting naive things. Most of the time, it's people trying to take advantage of others.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is certainly where, you know, your business skill comes into, like, negotiating. And, you know, a lot of people aren't very good at the negotiation process. And
yeah.
You know, but yeah, I mean, where do you negotiate with somebody when it's like, we have no money and, like, okay, this thing should cost $400.
Yeah.
You know, and $400 is a modest sale for anything that you and I are taking.
Yeah.
But, you know, our budget's not at all, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And then to go to the level of like, oh, well, this is a $15,000 sale for what you're asking. But, you know, no, it's free. You should be happy that you're going to give us, you know, the picture. And so.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I guess the point is, you know, it's no use complaining about it all day. But, you know, having this up on the web and having it as a communal resource, if, you know, people are photographers, whether they're professional or amateur or just having fun, should take a read. And, you know, understand what's going on. And, you know, you can never tell somebody what to think, but you can ask them to think about it.
Yes. Yes. That's what I was saying. That's exactly what I'm doing when I, you know, point out that if you don't necessarily need to make money at it, you also have no incentive to, like, just give it away either. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, I'll include a link when I post this, but
myself and everybody certainly really, you know, happy and proud that you did that. And, you know, I think it's going to be helpful for a lot of people. So.
Well, I hope so. It's prevented me from doing any real work for about 3 days.
That too.
and my friend, Matt Oldfield, who's been helping with the back end, just answering emails and posting responses and stuff like that too. He's been good about that.
Well, it sounds like you got out there before you let my wife finish editing it too. So
yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right.
It's gone into like two languages officially. Two are in process.
Yeah.
So there's an Italian translation, a Thai translation.
Well, if anybody is worried about like having the fully authorized, you know, edited version, I guess they can contact you through our
bots. Yeah.
The final edit, so.
Yeah, I think photographers were more concerned about the content.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it just happened so fast.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I mean, the first morning when I woke up, my inbox was
I didn't start that too naively or early on you, you know, because I was started it the day before, and I just thought I was going to share it with people that follow me online, and then obviously, like, I saw how many people linked to that right away, and that's how it started. So
yeah, I thought, you know, I don't know, maybe 100 people or
yeah, that's exactly what I thought, and then you know, it grew way beyond that so quickly. So I was like, oh man, I hope Tony doesn't get mad at me for jumping the gun on this. So
the first less than 48 hours, there were on the back end 21,000 or so unique IP views.
Wow.
So it was, yeah, I mean, it's not viral by the, like, YouTube standards.
Yeah.
In the photography world, that's pretty big.
Yeah.
Well, so anyway, enough about that.
Yep.
So I guess we've got more trips coming. I'm planning on staying put for a little while, but we've got trips coming up, and I'll be putting up some information about our joint humpback trips next year, which in Alaska and Tonga, probably early next week or thereabouts.
Okay.
And shortly thereafter, you're gonna post more information about your polar bears.
Yeah, so I'm working on my, you know, the proverbial working on the website, but I have a business manager I'm kind of working with right now, a business consultant, that we're making some changes that I hope to have fully implemented by the middle of November.
Great.
And so then I'll be updating my, you know, our tour together with the humpbacks next summer. Definitely the polar bears with Steve and I again next September, October. And then I've actually got a few other trips that I'm working on with a few other photographers, and hopefully you and I will get something else going for 2013. So, yeah, I'll be working on all that here the next couple of weeks. And
okay, sounds good. Okay, so I actually have to get to work.
Yeah, it's morning time still for you, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And I've successfully skipped dinner with my family here tonight. So,
okay,
yeah,
all right. Well, good talking to you. Good catching up with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll look forward to talking again here online. I hope everybody enjoys listening to this conversation tonight.
Okay. All right, talk to you later.
Thanks, Tony.
All right, bye.